Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We will call this meeting of the Capital Investment Committee to order. We do have a quorum starting out today. That's good news. I would have Jenny approve the minutes, but she's not a member of the committee. But she does have a special occasion today, and it was in my power to name you as a special member of the committee so you could approve the minutes on your birthday. I would, but I can't do that. So, congratulations on reaching another milestone in your life. It's good news.
And unfortunately, we're so busy that we can't even celebrate it today. So,
I see. Well, we'll celebrate it in our hearts. Representative Lilly, would you care to move to approve the minutes of March 10th?
Happy to move that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lilly moves that we approve the minutes of March 10th. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed by the same sign. Thank you, members. We have a number of presentations today, so we'll get started right away. We're starting out with the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities this morning, or this afternoon, I'm sorry. And I believe former Representative Dorman is first on the agenda. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan Dorman. I'm the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Partnership. The partnership has over 90 members throughout Greater Minnesota. It would include things like EDAs, Chambers of Commerce's, individual businesses, and others. The focus of our organization is economic development in Greater Minnesota. And I'm joined here today, as you mentioned, with our sister organization, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. And Mr. Chair, you know, I had the good fortune in 2000 and 2005 and 6 to be the chair of this committee, and it was a wonderful experience, and I am so pleased for you to have that same opportunity. And to start with a testimony, I just say, as you assemble your bill and you think about how to do that, how to get that done, I would encourage you to, as much as possible, build a base of infrastructure projects, clean water projects, local roads and bridges, higher education projects, and funds like the BDPI program and redevelopment. Our priorities are infrastructure and the overall balance of the bill. But if you start from that base, that you will build a very high-quality bill that will serve all of Minnesota and position us for growth and prosperity in the future. My comments today will be limited to the Greater Minnesota Business Development Public Infrastructure Program, often referred to as the BDPI program. And we are very pleased as an organization and our members to support Governor Dayton and his $21 million request in his bonding proposal for the program. And we're hopeful that this committee will include that number in your final bill. Realizing that it is a large number, but I look back a little bit, and in 05 and 10, $10 million were put in, and those dollars were out in almost a year. So I believe that this $21 million, if it's approved, would actually go out fairly rapidly. There are good projects out there that are seeking funding and that will come forward. The BDPI program provides grants to Greater Minnesota cities of up to 50%, often much less, of the capital costs associated with the infrastructure necessary to grow our tax base and create jobs in Greater Minnesota. Since 2003, over 9,500 jobs have been created or retained using this program. You should be getting a handout that shows on the back of it. It shows where some of the recent projects have been. They've been spread throughout Greater Minnesota. They don't all just go to the regional centers. They go down some real small towns. I had the good fortune when I was the EDA guy in Overlea to write a small $50,000 grant for a community of about 283 people, and nobody ever really helped them before, and they were ecstatic for the 12 jobs that helped to create. So it's all sorts of cities that benefit from this program throughout the state. One of the recent projects that was recently funded was a project in Owatonna for a company called Daikin Applied Americas. And with me today, I have the mayor of Owatonna, Mayor Tom Coons, and Craig Vatsas, who is their director of operations. And they would like to talk to you about that. And so I will cease my testimony, happy at any point to answer any questions that you, Mr. Chair of the committee, has, and turn it over to the mayor and Craig.
Thank you, Representative Dorman. A question for you, I believe, from Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you're not the one, you know, you can refer to somebody else. I think one of the things you're proposing is changes that would allow industrial park development prior to commitments by a business. So right now, you appropriately say there's an outstanding return on investment because we know when we build the infrastructure what's going to happen there, but I think you're suggesting a change that would say we put the infrastructure in before there's business development. And so help me understand how we would avoid another elk run.
Representative Dorman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, I didn't hear the last part. How we would avoid another...
And how we would avoid another elk run. Remember, that was... Sure. We were so sure these California companies, these high-tech companies, were going to come in, and they would love to be there.
Right. As I recall... Well, I would say, Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, a couple things. I think that conceptually, we can talk about how this would work, and then we have to figure out the language. Because I think that in a lot of communities, I'll use Albert Lea for example, if Albert Lea were to apply for a speculative, let's call it speculative, a grant under the BEPI program, then he really shouldn't get it because we have an ample supply of industrial property ready to go. But if you don't have that in your community, and when you get the call from your regional deed representative, and so like when I was doing EDA work for the city of Albert Lea, you'll get the call or the email, and it'll say, hey, do you have a 10-acre site ready to go? And if your answer is no, they're on to the next community. You have no opportunity then to continue in that process. And so it's a little bit of a chicken and an egg thing. You have to have some available supply in order to do any economic development, but we have to be careful for the reason that you have outlined is that you don't want just a bunch of properties dispersed throughout the state that isn't going to be used. So I think and we're working with DEED hoping to find some language that can accomplish that, because I really do understand that concern of overproduction, but I do also know that if you're a city, say, size of 7,500, and you answer that question, I don't, but gee, what I could do is apply for this DEED grant and we could do blah, 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 blah. DEED will then move down the road and they'll go to the next city that replies or the next state. And so it's kind of a fine balance. How do we make sure that a city, and I don't know what Albert Lea would apply, but you don't want them to, that wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't be good use of those funds. So we have to find some language that will give DEED the flexibility to say that doesn't make any sense. You have it. So it really should be only communities that have no available property ready to go. It doesn't mean you should put a 1,000-acre industrial park either. I mean, you know, you've got to give some thought to it. So conceptually, I think it's a good idea, and I think we just have to find some language that makes everybody comfortable, because I do appreciate and understand your concern, because you don't want another elk run. I agree with you on that.
And, Mr. Chair, I've even pushed back on my own county. We have something that used to be called TCAP, the Twin Cities Army Ammunition Plant, which is now cleaned up. And now they call it Rice Creek Commons, and I've pushed back there the same way, because their point was, well, we have to put in all this infrastructure so that somebody will come. And I've always thought you kind of have to, you know, somehow the two of them have to move together.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, and I also think there's some scale. And maybe that's the lesson from Elk Run. If you really have a project that's massive, right? So we're not talking about opening up 10 acres for a town. We're talking about what happened there. That maybe that should stand alone. I mean, maybe we need to think through that process of how we do those bigger projects. And by and large, the projects in the metropolitan area are of significant size. I mean, TCAP's a good project. We certainly wouldn't speak ill of it. I sort of understand that. I don't know if it's the same on par of that community that has no industrial property ready to go. I guess I don't understand the Ramsey County maybe as much as I do Greater Minnesota, but not my job to either. I'm sure you appreciate that. But I am appreciative and respectful and understand everything you're saying and agree with you on those points.
Thank you.
I'll turn it over to Mr. Coons and representative from the company. Mr.
Please
Chair.
Do.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
I'm Mayor Tom Coons, Mayor of the City of Owatonna, and Mr. Chairman and committee members, it's a real honor and privilege to be able to come and tell Owatonna's story and the importance of these grants into our community. You know, Owatonna is a great community, but it makes it great because we got great industry within our community. But the industry is also has the opportunity to move other areas. I'll use Viracon as an example. Viracon wanted to expand. We had to compete with Georgia and Utah in order to keep that manufacturing in Owatonna. They produce architectural glass. They produce about 80% of the architectural glass in the United States, and they're in the worldwide market. They put the glass that went into the Pentagon after 9/11. They put the glass in Freedom Towers. And what their expansion is about is that the world market now takes larger glass than it has in the past. And so they needed to expand in order to manufacture and coat these larger glass panels. They installed the largest coater in the United States in Owatonna, Minnesota. This expansion was really competitive. We had to compete with Georgia and Utah. One of the things that really helped in that expansion was the grant money that we were able to receive in this program. Without that being part of that package, we wouldn't have been so successful. Bush & Boy Tomatoes is a manufacturer of tomatoes, and it has a market from the Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and down into the Chicago area. We were fortunate enough to get another grant for them to put in a stormwater retention pond. That's in the process of doing it now. These grants are privileged, Owatonna, but it's not without cost. We have to put our share into this, too. So I think the stormwater retention pond that's going into Bush & Boy, I think the grant was about $400,000. City of Owatonna's got to put in $200,000 in order to match that, in order to make that happen. For a city to find $200,000 that's not in his budget in order to make that go forward gets to be a challenge. But it's very, very rewarding when we get the money from the state to assist us in that process. The other one is Daikin Manufacturing. And I will have Craig, which is a representative from Daikin, share their story.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes. My name is Craig Vatsis. I'm Director of Operations for Daikin Applied Americas. We produce and manufacture HVAC for commercial industry, for buildings. Freedom Tower was a project that our business helped with and assisted with, just as it described Viracon being part of that in Owatonna. Our manufacturing sites were a big part of the Freedom Tower and providing the heating and cooling for that. For that building. So just give you some reference what we do. The business infrastructure grant that helped us here recently, we made a commitment to both the city and the state and developed a package that had the infrastructure grant, job creation fund, Minnesota Investment Fund, tax increment financing from the city. And all of those tools enabled us to invest within Owatonna, and we were able to expand our facility with that infrastructure grant. We had a commitment of 40 jobs for that particular project. We've been able to double that to more than 80 jobs with part of this infrastructure. Without that, there were other opportunities. Daikin is a global company, and there's opportunities to invest elsewhere in the United States, Mexico, globally. There were other sites that were options, and both the partnership with the city and the state gave us an opportunity to bring more jobs and more skilled jobs to Owatonna and greater Minnesota.
Very good.
And I think one of the advantages that we look at when we do these with Daikin and Viracon is kind of regional stormwater retention ponds, and it helps build for the future. Daikin was able to take advantage of that stormwater retention pond, and as we grow and we have other industry come into it, that stormwater retention pond continues to be able to provide services for other businesses as we look into the future.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mayor Kunz. Thank you, Mr. Okay. Say it for me.
Vatsis.
I got it. I don't see any questions among the committee members. So, I'm sorry. Representative Runback, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Vatsis, maybe, or the mayor. So does this, I have not looked at the statute pertaining to this, but does it specify, maybe Mr. Dorman, specify what kinds of projects will be funded and what will not? I mean, is there any question about sort of whether the money will be funding equipment, or is that a fairly clear definition and a clear line?
Representative Dorman.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chairman, Representative, the answer, Representative Runbeck, is that, yes, it's very specific at what can be funded. It's public infrastructure, which could include things like a street and sewer project. It couldn't include any, particularly the bond dollars. If you, with a cash allocation, you could, of course, do other things. But with the restrictions that come with bond dollars, you're limited to public infrastructure. So in this case, a regional stormwater pond is located on property owned by the city of Owatonna would qualify. But work on a site, whether it's for any of this company or another, you couldn't do this site prep or the site work with that. You couldn't buy equipment, that type of stuff. The state has other programs that can do those things. This is public infrastructure. Can't be used for retail, can't be used for housing. It's very specific. It's targeted primarily manufacturing.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, oh, I'm sorry. Representative Erdahl has a question.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as Representative Runbeck, this is very specific. For example, if you want to do electric generation under BDPI, you couldn't do that unless you added it on there, which I don't intend to do. But what I did want to ask Representative Dorman, the where it says that you want to increase the maximum amount from 1 million to 2 million, and deeds application form erroneously states a grant limit of 250,000. Now, I just want some clarification. Did deed just make a mistake?
Representative Dorman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, yeah, I think they have, and they've corrected it. I'm not sure what the reasons behind it were, but we did have one or two cities that didn't apply because they thought that was the limit. In statute, there's a limit currently of $1 million per community. It's not per project. And I think deed is even in language. They're going to come forward to boost that to 2 million. Just really needs to be updated in terms of inflation, the size of the projects. But to that specific question, it's 1 million per community, and the push should be to go to 2 million. It would just include more projects. Doesn't mean that anything else would necessarily get funded. By the way, it just would give the opportunity to apply.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So just so I understand, so it doesn't say anything about 250,000. In legislation anywhere that would lead to that.
Representative Dorman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl. In legislation, no, but if you do look at the amount of grants that have been awarded on that page, you'll see some earmarks, but you're going to see a vast majority of the grants have been at $250,000. So I don't know if I'm characterizing this correctly, and it might be a better question for somebody from DEED, but in my former job in Albert Lea, for example, we applied for and got a grant, and I knew what the maximum amount of that grant was going to be before the application went in. So because dollars have been limited, they've been, and I'm not saying this is a criticism, but they have been shrinking the percentage of projects that have been funded, and there was an informal $250,000 cap, as you can see reflected in many of those projects. And I
thank you.
Not a criticism of anybody's, just
thank you, Representative Dorman. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, Mr. Vasquez, and we'll continue to the next presentation. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Hi, I'm Roger Alsgaard from the city of Breckenridge. Chair Torkelson and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today about the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities priorities for the capital investment bill. I oversee the public services, including the utilities, wastewater treatment facility for the city of Breckenridge, and Breckenridge has been a longtime member of this CGMC. Our city, along with every other city in Minnesota, play an important role in keeping the waters of Minnesota clean and ensuring that citizens have clean drinking water. However, it's getting more expensive as we have to fulfill certain roles, and our financial resources are not limitless. Cities like mine are facing a variety of challenges. Our infrastructure is aging and may need to be upgraded or replaced in the future. Increased regulations are also leading to expensive upgrades for many cities. In Greater Minnesota, the costs of upgrades are spread over fewer and fewer people, which means a larger burden on our citizens. federal grant money that was available when most of the systems were initially built has also been drying up. Paying for these upgrades isn't our city's only responsibilities. We still have to provide public safety, snow plowing libraries, and a variety of other things. The Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities believes that bonding for the water infrastructure should be a foundation for the 2016 capital investment bill. We do support the governor's proposed $167 million for our state's aging infrastructure, including the $62 million for point source implementation grant, $80 million for the wastewater infrastructure funding program, and the $25 million for the EPA matching grants. We also believe that it is important to cap the cap on the point source program be increased to $7 million and that the percentage of eligible costs be increased to 80%. Let me tell you a little bit how this could support a city like Breckenridge. Breckenridge is located on the Red River of the North, along the North Dakota-Minnesota border. Our population is aging, and we've lost a lot of economic development just over the river to Wahpeton, North Dakota, through the years. Because of where we're located, our drinking water is very hard and requires softening to use. Breckenridge has an existing plant that softens the water using lime. This means that the residents of Breckenridge don't have to have separate water softeners in their houses that put salt into the water. This keeps significant amounts of chloride that is in the salt from going into our rivers. Our plant is more than 80 years old and needs replaced, so we can continue keeping additional chlorine or chlorides from getting into the water. It's not cheap. We're expecting to pay $13 million or more for our new treatment plant. In 2014, we raised our rates from $32 a month to $56 a month in anticipation for funding the new water treatment plant, which we, at that time, was estimated to cost about $6.5 million. If we do not receive grant assistance, our rates will go up to approximately $70 a month. On top of that, we may also need to increase our wastewater rates to up to $12 a month to meet increased discharge standards. That's a huge burden on our citizens and makes it hard to compete with the city of Wahpeton, where the rates for their water are approximately $34 a month. Putting more money into the PFA's grant program will help Breckenridge and other cities afford to take steps to keep Minnesota waters clean. I'm proud of the work that I do in Breckenridge, ensuring that Minnesota waters are clean, and I know the colleagues in other greater Minnesota cities feel the same way. We will continue to take the steps that's required to ensure that the water is clean, but we are asking legislature to invest in these efforts by putting more money into the infrastructure programs. Thank you.
Thank you. I don't see any questions. Please introduce yourself. Oh, Representative Erdahl, do you have a question? You'll wait till the... You'll wait one more. All right. Very good. Go ahead. Introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Chair Torkelson and members of the committee. My name is Tom Schmitz. I'm the Director of Parks and Recreation Department for the City of New Ulm. I administer the largest department in city government with a $3.6 million annual budget. New Ulm consistently ranks near the top of the 850 so communities in Minnesota as far as per capita spending on parks, trails, and recreation. New Ulm, as a member of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, is also a member of the Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails Organization. And we have been working with Representative Norns and others on a House File 2852 proposal to put $2.5 million each into the Local Trails Connection Program and the Outdoor Recreation Grant Program. Our Greater Minnesota cities are supportive of that proposal, as are other statewide organizations such as the Parks and Trails Council of Minnesota. These two grant programs provide money where Legacy Amendment doesn't. For example, Local Trail Connection Program helps build connections between cities and nearby regional trails and state trails. In New Ulm, that could link to Flandreau State Park, the Minnesota River State Trail, and other connections. The Outdoor Recreation Grant Program helps acquire, develop, and redevelop park and recreation areas, and throughout its history has had a statewide reach. In New Ulm, that could assist with a multitude of projects, including safety and accessibility projects needed in many of our parks. These programs have received bonding money in the past, but it's been at least 8 to 10 years, and other sources going into these funds have also dried up. the local trail connection program, and two other DNR programs split 3% of lottery and lieu money, approximately $800,000 in fiscal year 17, for all of Greater Minnesota. This year, the Outdoor Recreation Grant Program will receive a small amount of federal funding, less than $400,000. Parks and trails are integral parts of Minnesota communities throughout the state. They help our cities attract much-needed younger workers, families, and retain active retirees and help build healthy communities. Recreation spending is a major contributor to state and local economies. In New Ulm, the 3M plant manager, the Kraft Heinz plant manager, and the New Ulm Medical Center president often tout the recreation, parks, and trail system in New Ulm when they're recruiting engineers, doctors, and workers for their businesses. These grant programs are essential complement to the work being done by all three of the main park agencies in Minnesota, the DNR, the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission, and Metro Parks and Trails. We hope that you will help restore this important funding for Greater Minnesota cities and counties. Thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Schmitz. It's always a pleasure to have one of my constituents at the testifiers' table. I believe Representative Erdahl has a question for you.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back to Mr. Evelsgard. Is that you?
Yep.
Sir, just a question. You said your system is 80 years old?
Mr. Evelsgard.
Chair and Representative, yes, our current existing water treatment plant was built in the mid-1930s.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
Just one of the process, wondering about the process a little bit. You know, it's an 80-year-old system. Does the state enter in and tell you that you have to do something?
Mr. Evelsgard.
Chair and Representative, the state does come in every, I believe, quarterly. They come in and do the inspections. Our plant has not been on the violation portion of it. We do a fairly good amount of upkeep and maintenance, but we are not in violation of any state statute that I'm aware of.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just wondering, maybe you know or maybe someone else does, if the state did enter in and say that you had to do this, and because there wasn't enough money available and you did not get a grant, and or any town, and they said no, we're just not going to do it, what happens?
Mr. Evelsgard.
Chair and Representative, I guess I'm not sure about the question. I guess what I'm taking out of the question is, if the state would come in and we are in violation at that point, there is other avenues of grant money available for upgrading, but since we are within compliance, some of that money is not available. If we have a issue where we're out of compliance, the state does come in, and I believe there is fines levied against us or warnings, depending upon the severity of it.
Okay.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just concluding, maybe a better example would have been somebody who's delinquent up here, so I appreciate that you're not. But the point I'm trying to make is that I like to see as much as we can put into PFA, and I don't know what that amount would be, but we do have a lot of cities across the state of Minnesota that do have problems and cannot do what needs to be done because of their limited money, limited populations, or whatever. And so you know, I'm just thinking about what could happen to these cities if something isn't done, and that's why I've been a supporter of PFA for a long time.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dean has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my question is for Mr. Schmitz. What percentage of the park budget is actually paid for by property owners in New Ulm?
Mr. Schmitz.
Chair Torkelson, Representative, approximately a third.
Okay. And I just thank you.
Representative
Dean. Mr. Schmitz, And you said that New Ulm spends more per capita than any other city in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Schmidt.
Chair Torkelson, Representative, we're near the top of, the last time I looked, I think we were in the fifth, somewhere in the top five of the 840 municipalities, okay, per capita spending and size and scope of system.
Okay.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so do you know if you're above Minneapolis per capita?
Mr. Schmitz.
Chair Torkelson, Representative, I do not think we are above Minneapolis. I think they are near the top, if not the top.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Schmidt, I'm interested in the trail along the Minnesota River. I think it needs to be expanded. And I think I heard you say that you are looking to go to that trail, and I was wondering, what's the mileage and what would it cost for you to link up to that portion of the trail?
Mr. Schmitz.
Chair Torkelson, Representative Wagenius. New Ulm is on the Minnesota River, and we feel that we're an integral part of the Minnesota River State Trail system. And I think that we have two, we have a parkway along the river, and we've got two municipal parks there. And we are working on a plan to make that connection. Preliminary estimates are in the $250,000 range to have a, you know, a sizable and successful connection and trail system through the municipality of New Ulm that is a part of the state trail system of the Minnesota River Valley.
Representative Wagenius, a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have constituents in South Minneapolis and Richfield who would like to be able to go along the trail all the way up to where you are. So we need, there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Thank you. I didn't hear a question there, so thank you for the comment. I appreciate it. Gentlemen, I think you're finished, and we'll move on to the next presentation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Are we waiting for technology?
I do believe we are waiting for technology.
All right. We'll hold on just a minute while that warms up. There we go. Very good. Welcome to the east side of the river, and welcome to the Capital Investment Committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you very much, Chair Torkelson and members of the committee. I am Betsy Hodges. I am the mayor of Minneapolis, and I appreciate very much the opportunity to come today to talk about our capital investment priorities for the city of Minneapolis. And you will see that our priorities reflect the city's commitment to protecting our infrastructure and our investments and serving the region and in preserving Minnesota's history. And so we'll get, I have a PowerPoint that I'll walk through with all of that. But in addition to our three priorities as a city, I would also like to voice the city's strong support for the 35W Lake Street Transit Access Project. It's a Hennepin County request. It's a joint effort between the City of Minneapolis and Hennepin County, and it's connected to the MnDOT Chapter 152 Bridges to the North and the Orange Line. So it's an important regional and statewide project, and it will leverage significant federal resources that will ensure the timely completion of other related projects that are being constructed at the same time, and increase access to jobs and educational opportunities through improved and expanded transit service to currently underserved communities in Minneapolis. So it is an important project for the city. I know that you will be getting a presentation on it, I believe, later this week, but I wanted to make sure that you knew the city's strong support for that project. And with that, I'd like to walk you through our three priorities. I will note I am joined this afternoon by Ms. Lesh from our government affairs team here in Minneapolis. And then also today we have our Director of Public Works, Steve Kotke, and our Fire Chief, John Friedel, is with us today to answer any questions that may come up about these projects. First is our request for the 10th Avenue Bridge rehabilitation, $31.875 million request. Total project cost is $42.5 million. The importance of this bridge connection cannot be understated. I know that a number of you were on it during the 35W bridge collapse. It was a place to see the collapse for a number of legislators, and it's also where a lot of traffic went while the bridge was down, which hastened the need to do this project. It spans the Mississippi River, connecting the University of Minnesota and new and emerging development on the East Bank to downtown Minneapolis and other major regional assets and investments. It was the emergency route for the 35W Bridge. It's also the reliever to large events at the University of Minnesota and the Minnesota Vikings Stadium. So it gets a lot of use as those assets are being used as well. The annual average daily traffic count on the bridge was 9,800 in 2012. There's an estimated 2,040 bike and pedestrian trips on the bridge per day in 2009, the last time that we did a count. And this is key. Without rehabilitation, the bridge will eventually have to be replaced or demolished. The cost of a bridge replacement project is estimated to be $125.5 million. A bridge demolition project is estimated to be $21.5 million. So the scope of the project: to design and construct a major rehabilitation of the 10th Avenue Southeast Bridge over the Mississippi River between the West River Parkway and 2nd Street Southeast in Minneapolis. The project will address the ongoing deterioration of concrete on the spandrel columns, floor beams, arches, and on the bridge deck itself. It will restore the historic structure and add a minimum of 40 years to the useful life. Details of the work include replacing the deck and parapet on the arch spans, replacing and patching deteriorated floor beams and spandrel columns, patching the piers and arches, protection of the spandrel columns, arches, and piers. It says cathodic protection, and I have to confess to you, I'm not sure what cathodic means, but if any of us need to know, we can ask Mr. Kotke. And the new surface finish of the entire bridge. The bridge needs redoing, or we're going to have to shut it down, or we're going to have to demolish it and build a whole new one. And it is a key part of people's ability to get through the Twin Cities and to be able to use the other regional assets that we have. And it, like I said, the 35W bridge collapse hastened the deterioration. I mean, it just got a lot more use during the bridge collapse. I am not an engineer, so I don't want to make claims. But it got a lot more use, and it was a bridge that needed help even then. Our second project, the Emergency Operations and Training Facility Expansion, $2.5 million, is the total request. The total project cost is $5 million. The Emergency Operations and Training Facility is a one-of-a-kind, multi-agency public safety facility used to train first responders, fire professionals, law enforcement officials, technical rescue and hazardous materials specialists, as well as state and federal incident management personnel. I have family as well as friends, in addition to the employees that I know, who have been trained at the facility, and it is very useful for them to have had that training. It houses local, regional, and state equipment necessary to respond to Minnesota's emergencies. And since it opened in 2010, the EOTF has provided training opportunities for thousands of first responders from throughout the entire state, including the main training site for the state of Minnesota structural collapse team. So definitely a statewide use there. The new capacities would include rail disaster response training, urban search and rescue, structural collapse, and confined space rescue. The location allows for easy daily access for dozens of jurisdictions from around Minnesota, and hundreds of agencies have used the EOTF, and many more will with the expansion. Finally, we have the Pioneers and Soldiers Cemetery fence restoration. The total request is $1.029 million to complete a $2.584 million project. The cemetery, the fence, was established in 1853. And part of the reason this work is so important is because Pioneers and Soldiers Cemetery is the oldest surviving cemetery in Minneapolis. It's a portrait of early Minnesota. It's the final resting point for over 22,000 individuals. Only 1 in 10 graves are actually marked. 60% of those buried here are children under the age of 10. Many actually died drinking contaminated water. The only cemetery in Minnesota listed as an individual landmark on the National Register of Historic Places. It's an integrated cemetery with ties to the abolitionist movement, and it contains the graves of soldiers from the War of 1812, from the Civil War, and from the Spanish-American War. The scope of the project: we need to protect this state and national treasure with a secure and historically representative fence. Much of the fence piers are done. What remains is to restore 65 historic piers. Structural assessment is needed. Repoint and tuck point to rebuild, make waterproof, to have a new base. And currently, the water is getting on top of the piers, and the freeze-thaw compromises the condition of them. And that is getting worse over time. As those of us in Minnesota know, the freeze-thaw and the cumulative effect of that. There will be new fence along 21st Avenue. It's currently a chain-link fence, and it will provide greater protection against vandalism than the chain-link fence that is currently there. So these are the projects that we have for the city of Minneapolis. I really appreciate the time that you have shown today and the consideration that you are giving to the projects, and I am happy to stand for questions, and we as a city are happy to stand for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your presentation, Mayor Hodges. We have a question from Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned one support item, so these are your official city ones and then the support item. Do you have any of the Minneapolis Park Board bonding requests as on your support agenda?
Mayor Hodges.
I would typically, the reason that I brought up the support for that project is because it is a joint project that we are doing with Hennepin County. It was a decision for them to have it on their list, but we are partners in that project. And while, of course, we support projects that are in Minneapolis, we don't have the same relationship vis-a-vis the direct partnership with the Park Board projects.
And Mr. Chair, I was thinking not that you had a partnership, but sometimes cities will have, in addition to their own agenda, they might add some support items for others that people are advancing. I didn't know if the city council acts on any of those.
Mayor Hodges.
I will defer to Ms. Lesh, Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative, for answers about do we have any other support items on our bonding agenda.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Melissa Lesh with the City of Minneapolis Office of Intergovernmental Relations. And Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, the city did not officially take action to include Park Board projects, as I know other cities have, kind of on their official list that was submitted through the process. The city is, however, very supportive in principle of everything that the Park Board has proposed to the legislature, that we don't have any concerns with their projects. We would be thrilled to see them happen in our city, but any official action was not taken.
Thank you. Mayor Hodges, can you tell me a little more about the cemetery? Has it always been a city-owned property?
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Ms. Lesh, I think, is the expert on the history of the cemetery, so I would defer to her.
Mr. Chair, an excellent question. The cemetery was originally established in 1853 by the Lehman family, and they were some of the founding members of the First Presbyterian Church in Minneapolis, which was very active in the anti-slavery movement at the time. After Mr. and Mrs. Lehman passed away, the cemetery stayed in the hands of the family for several years, but as the generations expanded and the family got larger and moved nationwide, really, in 1928 is when the city stepped in and took ownership over the cemetery, that the grave markers were deteriorating and vandalism was happening and things of that nature. So it was at that point in time that the city took ownership of the property.
Thank you very much. I sit on the cemetery board, so I'm, kind of curious about these things. With that, Representative Runbeck has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mayor Hodges. I guess I didn't really understand that the bridge has such a long life history. 1929 it was built. So have there been other periods when there was major renovation and work done on it, or has the structure been satisfactory up until now?
Mayor Hodges.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I will ask Mr. Kotke to come down and answer questions about the history of the bridge.
Very good. Welcome, committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, committee, I am Steve Kotke. I'm the Director of Public Works for the City of Minneapolis. Yes, that we have done a major rehab on the bridge previously. In 1970, the bridge reached somewhat of a similar condition that we have today. And at that point, we actually closed the bridge for eight years and did a similar restoration that we're talking about today. So it's been about 40 years ago that we did the restoration on the bridge previously.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Runbeck.
Will you be required then to shut the, you said 8 years it was shut down?
Yeah.
And how long will it be shut down, I guess, this time?
Mr. Chair, committee, surprisingly, it took us 8 years back in the 70s to do the work that we did at that time. However, this time around, we're anticipating that it would be closed. We are anticipating it would probably be a year to a year and a half of closure as we work through the particulars. We'll have a bit more refinement on those time frames, but it'd be much, much shorter period of time.
Thank you.
Thank you. I do not see any other questions. Thank you for coming to our committee today and for your presentation, and we look forward to working with you.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee for your time.
Next, we come to this side of the river, I believe. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Capital Investment Committee. I understand the mayor is on his way. Is that correct?
The mayor is on his way, and he does apologize for his tardiness. In the meantime, I do have some staff on hand that can walk through the presentation and are happy to take any questions, and hopefully he gets here before we wrap up.
I think that'll work out just fine. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Katie Knutson. I'm the Government Relations Manager for the City of St. Paul. I have with me here today our bridge engineer, Brent, and he will kick off our presentation with the Kellogg 3rd Street Bridge.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Oh,
he is. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brent Christensen, City of St. Paul. And with that, I'll turn it back over to our mayor, Mr. Chris Coleman.
You know, I think you, it's good to have a, nice. I think he holds the record for the shortest presentation before the Capital Investment Committee.
That's great. Well, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mayor, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Chris Coleman, Mayor of the City of St. Paul. Forgive me for rushing in at the last second here, but.
Welcome to committee.
Hopefully the mayor of Minneapolis didn't take all the money yet, so we.
No one's gotten any money yet, Mr. Mayor.
Well, let's hope that I break that pattern. Thank you so much for your consideration of this. I'd like to present the St. Paul bonding priorities. As you know, the top of the list on our bonding priorities, the 3rd Street Bridge, this is certainly not something that would have been on my priority list, but for the fact that this is an urgent situation. This is a bridge that was once under the domain of the state of Minnesota, was turned back over to the City of St. Paul. Unfortunately, the way it was designed was structurally sound at the time, but recently we found that the design was deficient and quite frankly had to be significantly restricted in terms of the use of that bridge. The cantilevered approach to it, some of you members may have had an opportunity to get up in the bucket and get up and see some of the cracking on the bridge. But we've had to have this major access point to the City of St. Paul into the downtown area, and more importantly over to Metropolitan State and the east side, a neighborhood that desperately needs better access. We've had to significantly restrict that bridge, and it is in the kind of condition that needs to be replaced almost immediately. There are a lot of reasons why I think that this project is important. One of them certainly is the fact that we've had a lot of state investment through over the years in Metropolitan State University. That university is serving many, many people in our community that might not otherwise have a chance for college. And access to that university is important, but also access to the jobs in downtown becomes increasingly important. If you remember, you know, if you know the geography of St. Paul, we're not quite Rome, but we have seven hills. And in order to get into the downtown, you either have to cross a river or you have to come across a bluff line somewhere. So we have limited access points, and when you shut down one of those major access points, it makes it very, very difficult for us to continue the flow. And as we look at the crowds that we're seeing in Lower Town for various events, including events at CHS Field, this becomes important. The engineers can speak more directly to the challenge with the engineering. But when this problem came to me, I was very clear, find me an engineer that will sign off on this bridge, and there isn't one anywhere in the country that will tell me that this bridge is safe right now. So there is a very significant, very serious problem, and I think it needs, I appreciate the support of the committee as we look to do a reconstruction of this bridge. There's been some question as to reconstruction versus refurbishment of it. We believe that the complete reconstruction is really the only option, given the excess demands for this, given the challenges, and quite frankly, given the cost and the uncertainty associated with refurbishment versus reconstruction. I stand for questions relative to the bridge, but we also have a couple of other priorities we'd like to present to you. The second one is the Environmental Learning Center. That's part of the Great River Passage. In terms of regional significance, the Mississippi River and how we interact with the river, how we use that asset to bring students down to that river and learn, get outside. I'm a huge believer that we need more of our children getting outside into the wilderness, whether that's canoeing down the river or walking through the woods. There's lots of evidence to show the importance of social-emotional learning attached to that. But to have a learning center along the banks of the Mississippi River will become an asset where students from across this region, if not from across the entire state of Minnesota, will come down and be a part of what's happening there. We've invested a lot in our riverfront. We have the largest, the most miles of shoreline of any city along the Mississippi River. We feel a special need to be protective of that, but also to help use that river as a learning tool for others. This particular project, for those of you that haven't had a chance to see it, it's down along the Watergate Marina. It is just basically across the river from Fort Snelling. It allows great access to the river, and we think can be an incredibly important learning tool that students from across the state will take advantage of. I could go on more about that. I'm just going to kind of skip through because I know the committee is pressed for time. The one thing that this committee, I think, has been extremely supportive of, and certainly Representative Hausman has been a champion of Como Park and the Como Zoo and Conservatory, continues to be one of the best assets for certain in the region that we have, I think, across the state of Minnesota. The number of visitors that go to that facility continues to be a free facility with voluntary donations. I can't tell you the number of families that have come up to me and said, that this has been a godsend for them. And it's not, if you look at who goes to it, it's not just a St. Paul residents. These are folks from across the state of Minnesota. We draw very heavily. Thousands and thousands of kids are come to the zoo on a yearly basis and participate in that. The challenge that we have here is that we're now running up against our certification. If we don't do something on this project, we lose accreditation or potentially run the risk of accreditation. I was supposed to bring the sloth here today, but I didn't get a chance to pick up the sloth. I was moving too slowly to get the sloth or something. Thank you for the support that you've given Como, but I think that that every investment that has been made in that has been paid off. The final priority that I'll present to you is the walk-on teepee center at the Bruce Vento Nature Sanctuary. This is part of the Lower Failing Creek Watershed Project. The center will be a multi-use interpretive visitor center that will serve both the local community and the region as part of the regional parks and trail system. The Vento Nature Sanctuary is really, truly an amazing asset to have something like that in the middle of a large urban area. is very unique in this country, and I think the enhancements that we made to it and the connections that we made to it have been important. The center will be located directly in the Nature Sanctuary, which is an award-winning park along the banks of the Mississippi River and the bluffs of the east side. The center will interpret the natural history and honor the cultural heritage of the Dakota tribes, as well as the many traditions and ethnic groups represented in the area. It's, this also, like the interpretive center, is part of the Great River Passage Plan, which has been a carefully crafted plan to really take advantage of the fact that we have the Mississippi River running through our backyard. As you know, many towns turn their backs on the rivers over the decades. Over the last couple of decades, we have returned to the river and turned to face the river in projects like the Interpretive Center, the Walk-On Teepee Center, and the investments that we made along the river have been incredibly important in accessing this great resource that we have. Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Not sure how to break this to you, but the Como Zoo was here a few days ago, so the sloth got here before you did.
Hey, when the sloth does crashed ice, he can talk.
A good comeback, Mr. Mayor. Thank you. I'm going to start out with a couple questions. First, we've been reading the news lately, and I see there's some cost overruns on a couple of projects in your city. Can you enlighten us a little bit on what's happening with Kellogg and Jackson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. As you know, that a few years ago, we were able to identify some resources, one-time resources that we had, to reinvest in the city that came out as a result of refinancing some old bonds that we had, and it freed up a good deal of resources. I didn't want that just to kind of evaporate into the air. I wanted to very specifically program the roads and trails in the city of St. Paul. We spent a lot of money fixing potholes with those resources, and then we put together what we call the 880 plan, which is a comprehensive plan to rebuild our streets, to make them more accessible, usable, walker-friendly, biker-friendly, et cetera, including the Daxon Street program that would include a portion of the downtown loop for bicycles. Biking is becoming an increasingly important asset, not just from a recreational standpoint, but if you look at how we are attracting young workers and businesses into town and the kind of amenities that they're looking for, they really are looking for a multimodal, opportunities to walk. The transit's been important. People still want to drive into downtown, but biking is becoming increasingly important. So we spent a lot of time putting a plan together relative to that. The cost estimates were very preliminary. We haven't had the resources, and therefore have not built major sections of roadway in downtown. And the engineers did not include in their preliminary estimates some of the actual costs associated with, including the expense of all the street lights, et cetera, stoplights, and some of those things that were pretty expensive. So it was a preliminary estimate. As we went further into engineering, it's kind of typical of a home remodeling project. You get an initial estimate, and then you go out to bid and you see what it's actually going to cost you. And somebody says, "Oh, you forgot. You got to make sure that you have a bathroom or a sink here. Or, the cost of windows have gone up or whatever that might be." So as we refine those costs, we got to a better. So it is not the case that it was a project that was already bid out and then the cost escalated. As we refined the actual scope of the project and got a better understanding of what it was fully going to cost to do that, that's where we saw the increase from the original preliminary estimate.
Well, thank you for that explanation. I appreciate it. Next, I'd just like to ask a little more about the Kellogg Bridge and the current amount of use on the bridge. I see you've got a traffic count on your presentation of 10,000 vehicles a day. How does that compare to other bridges in the neighborhood?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have that information directly in front of me in terms of how that compares. I would just, as I mentioned in my notes, that we have limited points of entry into the because of the geography of the city of St. Paul. Hmm. So I don't know how this would compare, for instance, to the Robert Street Bridge or Wabasha Street Bridge. We can get those numbers for you.
Yeah, I would appreciate that if you could get those numbers to the committee. It would be very much appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may just additionally point out that the challenge, particularly for this, the next point of entry to the east side, would really be down at the Highway 61 Warner Road intersection. So there, because of the bluff, this is the last opportunity for people that live on the or work or are going to school on the east side to enter. I mean, there is 7th Street as well, but that is also a capacity and limited.
So, and then again, regarding the Kellogg Bridge, in relation to the cost estimate, we talked about the two roads that have gone over your original cost estimates. Do you have confidence that the cost estimate on the Kellogg Bridge is accurate?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, based on everything that we have right now, and we're refining those, and our engineers are working on those numbers, as confident as we can be at this point, and obviously as we get more defined, as we get into the next stage of engineering, we'll know for sure how accurate these things are, but you know, it's not uncommon to have a 5 or 10% increase in cost just because of the, you know, if steel prices go up, or if President Trump builds a wall and uses up all the concrete, the cost of concrete might go up. So we're not sure, but based on our engineering at this point, we think we're fairly confident on these numbers.
Well, I've heard all the concrete is coming from south of the borders.
Well, they're paying for it. They're paying for it.
We have a question from Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mayor, nice to see you. I have a question about the visitor center at the Vento Nature Sanctuary. Have you done some studies in terms of, we're building this big, beautiful visitor center, and I understand it's a centerpiece for the trails and everything else, but what are the expected visits to the center, and how did you arrive at that?
Mayor Coleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I do not, I know there are representatives of the committee that might have more accurate information, so instead of me speculating, our new director of the Lower Failing Creek Project.
Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Melanie Kleiss, Executive Director for the Lower Failing Creek Project. As far as potential visits or visitors to the center, we don't have that specific information that I'm aware of yet, but I can look into that and let you know. I just started 2 months ago, so I'm still getting all the information myself. We do know that the park is well used now by a lot of different people, so we expect that the numbers would be fairly high.
Representative Uglum, a follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kleiss, do you have figures on how many people use the trail? And then a second question is, if we don't know how many people are going to visit the new building, how do we design or, you know, come up with a pre-design here when we don't know how many people are going to use it?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a perfect question, and I'm sure we do have some numbers. I don't have them with me today, so I will certainly get that to you and let you know what those.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you. If you can forward that information to the committee, that would be appreciated. Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mayor Coleman. I think over the years I've supported a lot of St. Paul's bonding proposals, and you know, you were talking about arteries moving through into the city and the Seven Hills. We have Smith Avenue with the High Bridge, and we have Cesar Chavez and Concord, and we've got a state highway that connects our communities, also known as Robert Street. And so you know, we're struggling trying to get dollars for that artery that connects our communities up to the Greater Dakota County and Highway 3. And I'm just wondering if you have any comments on, you know, the city working with the adjoining small cities on some of these projects, because it's a big ask on all of these safety and other projects that the city has as priorities.
Mayor Coleman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I first of all, really would love to work with surrounding communities to figure out how we can, you know, meet all of our needs, because it's critically important for St. Paul, for South St. Paul and West St. Paul to thrive as well, or whether you're Roseville or you know, any of our surrounding communities, as well as, you know, as we extend that further out. I think that we should have those conversations. I think that we certainly have had those in different contexts. I think the challenge for this one is the urgency of the nature of this. When you have an engineer that tells you that a bridge is going to fall down, and people, you know, the consequences of that, you know, the opportunity for long-term planning kind of gets curtailed, and you need to respond to an urgent situation. That's the challenge that we have here. So I would love to have those conversations and make sure that we're addressing the comprehensive situation so that we're all doing well.
Representative Lilling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I use that bridge quite a bit going into the city, you know, for the games you're talking about, and then a lot of folks from the East Metro certainly are. It's our pathway into your community, and I used it the other day when you were like the, I don't know if you know, he's the mayor did crashed ice, but all the media is focused on him. The rest of us are all falling in the background, but he's out
falling
there succeeding.
In the foreground.
He's out there succeeding, making us look good, but while the rest of us are going flying around. But I had a question not related to any of that. But what happened to St. Paul? How come you're not in the top 5 for St. Patrick's Day? And I was wondering, my daughter's band's going to be at Burger Mo's. I just wonder if you're going to be for Thursday, if you're going to be coming in.
Mayor O'Coleman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McLilly. The Irish in St. Paul don't need a special day to have a beer. We celebrate St. Patrick's Day 365, but sounds like Burger Mo's is the place to be. But I will say that one of the things that we have tried to do is really enliven that. We had the 2-block square area out in front of West 7th Street closed down on Saturday. Of course, it was a beautiful day. There were probably 50,000 people out there. During the course of the day, we had that same celebration after Crashed Ice on the Saturday Crashed Ice, where we had, you know, the 100,000 people that were viewing that event. You know, this is, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is our capital city, and we want people to come to our capital. We want people to enjoy it, whether it's going to Crashed Ice or to the Science Museum or to the visitor centers that we have before you. Tacoma Park, you know, we really do have worked very hard to open this up so that people feel like this is the place that they can come, bring their families, come to the Capitol, and view some of the incredible amenities that we've had. And I think that has shown off, not always in green beer.
Representative Runbeck has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I should pass, but I wanted to just address sort of with the same theme as Representative Uglem, Mr. Mayor, the Great River Passage, and just some thoughts on. I mean, I've never, maybe it's been in conception and design and so on for a long time, but hadn't heard much about where it came from and so on and so forth. So, and what's the expectation in terms of, you know, visitor interest, etc. I think it'd be helpful to have that. You don't have to provide it now, but these are nice to have things, and yet we are living in a world where there's, you know, some tremendous exigencies, and I guess we'll have to sort that out.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, thank you for the question. You know, to give you a short history, as I mentioned earlier, you know, for years cities turned their backs on rivers, and they put garbage dumps and junkyards and various things on those things, and really starting in the 70s with a gentleman named Dick Broeker, who worked for then Mayor Latimer, and then accelerating quite a bit through then Mayor Coleman in the vision that the community had to restore the riverfront, to make this not just the sewer channel through our backyard, but really an asset, led to a vision for the river that includes the Great River Passage Plan, but also includes the national park. We are blessed to be We're a mile away from a national park. People kind of forget that sometimes. But the Mississippi River that goes from the Coon Rapids Dam, I forget where the end of that is, probably down towards Hastings, is part of the national park system. That brings visitors from across the world to come and touch and see the Mississippi River. It's one of the great rivers of the world and is an incredible draw. But in order to take advantage of that, you do have to have facilities like the Interpretive Center, like the Wakan Teepee, that gives people an access point to the river so that they can learn about the history and the cultures along the river and have a reason to be there. And so it is important from an educational standpoint. I don't think that there's any question that the learning that can occur in these facilities is important. But secondly, it is a huge economic boost when we can draw people that will come to St. Paul to be to participate in those things. And so we think it is part of a long-term vision that has been in the making for many years through many administrations in the mayor's office, but with a lot of support from members of the legislature, and we've always appreciated that.
Representative Hausman has a question.
Was the woman coming up to answer the question about numbers?
I was just here. I'm Ellen Stewart. I'm with Parks and Recreation for the City of St. Paul, and I was just coming up in case he needed any support, which he did not.
Good answer.
Wow.
Just one.
Walking without a tightrope or without a safety line.
Just one follow-up to the bridge. I knew that it was because of some federal standard changes. What I didn't I notice on your slide, it sounds like the federal government, when those code revisions happened in 1983, they didn't tell the bridge owners that they had made those revisions. Is that what I see here?
Mayor Coleman.
Representative Hausman, I'll turn it over to someone who knows more than I do.
The guy with the net.
The guy with the net.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. The code changes that occur throughout time, including those from the 1980 code to subsequent codes, are not always expressed to the bridge owners in terms of changes that may cause a bridge that was structurally sufficient to become insufficient due to the code revision. And it's probably due to the fact that these code revisions often occur with many changes, and it's very, very infrequent, a very rare and unique case that any small change to a code in subsequent years would result in a significant change to a previously designed bridge structure. This bridge, in fact, it wasn't until 2014 when we were looking at teaming with a MnDOT contract already open and using the consultant to further review some pier cracking that we had been noticing, did we find that this change to the code enabling loads to be carried by internal members of the bridge, which was then later reverted, had occurred. And so to directly answer your question, no, it is not common practice for the many, many code changes that occur in each year of the bridge design code to be reflected to states or to the federal government in a way that bridge engineers can readily look at their already constructed bridges for conditions of this nature.
Mr. Christensen, is that right?
Yes, Brent Christensen.
Was this, the width of this bridge, was that the original design to have that many lanes supported by that particular structure?
Chairman, I believe that you're referring to the current bridge or the current configuration
the current
of lanes.
Configuration.
Okay. Yes, the current bridge width is something on the nature of 70 to 80 feet. It did support by design four traffic lanes as well as a single 10-foot sidewalk on the south side of the bridge. And then as the bridge nears Mounds Boulevard in the eastern two spans, it widens out to support a right turn lane onto southbound Mounds Boulevard. But yes, the lane configuration that was existent in 2014, for example, was the same lane configuration that was designed for originally in 1980.
Thank you. Representative Vogel has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just what the engineering estimate to repair it was.
Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the engineering estimate for repair, if memory serves me correctly, was approximately $13 million. Both of those estimates, speaking to earlier comments, I believe are forecasted for 2017 dollars.
Follow-up, Representative Vogel?
Mr. Chair, so dealing with the shortage of funds that we are and seeing that there's $15 million available from other sources, I don't know, maybe the federal commitment would change relative to percentages. As nice as it might be to have a new bridge, is there really serious consideration being given to just repairing it at this point and recognizing that sooner or later it might need to be replaced, but if we could extend the life, I'm not sure how long that would be, 10 or 20 years, you know, at least it gets it done and it provides safe access.
Mayor Coleman? Or
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think the challenge, and I'll let Brent talk more to this, is you would spend that money for basically duct tape and baling wire, and you would have a bridge that was kind of pulled together and last a while, but ultimately would still need to be replaced at much more, a much greater expense in the long term. So not only would the $15 million that you invested in initially have to be, you know, chucked, you would then, you know, with the cost of a replacement bridge 20 years from now, we can only imagine with inflation what those costs would be. In addition, I think there is an important proximity here to the Vento Nature Sanctuary, the trails, the riverfront itself, and to have a visitor to the city of St. Paul being greeted by something that's being held together by duct tape is not quite the image that we hope for our capital city. So I think it's in the long term, it's much more cost effective and quite frankly more beneficial for the city to take these steps initially.
Are you finished, Representative Vogel?
Mr. Chair, one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. On a bridge like this, normally what would you reserve or anticipate for annual maintenance cost? In other words, the bridge has been there since 1983, was it? Forget when it was originally constructed, what would you anticipate at this point in that age of that structure for any other bridge that you might have to sink into it just for normal maintenance?
Mr. Christensen?
Chairman and Representative, I unfortunately do not have those numbers in front of me from bridge maintenance. I could obtain numbers and provide them, if it pleases the committee, to, as I understand, to demonstrate what would the typical cost be for a bridge of this scale in maintenance dollars should there be no extenuating circumstances, or are we specifically talking about the cost for Kellogg Third Street Bridge moving forward, understanding that we have definitely significant challenges ahead of us with maintenance items that would be routine on other bridges, such as snow plowing or snow removal. If I could get some clarification on that,
sure. I'd appreciate it. Representative Vogel.
Ms. Chairman, what I'm looking at is I would assume that there are periods in time on any bridge where you run into a major renovation, a maintenance project, whatever you want to call it, because we're always going to have deterioration with the freeze thaw, the salt, and everything else. And just trying to compare that, was it $13 or $15 million that would be spent now to repair it and bring it up to usable condition relative to what we might have anticipated anyway over some period of time. I'm not sure when the last major maintenance was done on it, but just trying to get a relative feel for what we're doing here relative to replacement or with all of the other needs that we have. Is there a way to, I realize it's not aesthetically pleasing, but somehow get by, because obviously the safety of the public is a prime concern, but also it's just tough when you have over $4 billion of requests to make things work. So that was the intent.
Mr. Christensen.
Chair, committee member, just in quick response with regards to a routine maintenance, in addition to routine maintenance, to give you a feel for this particular bridge, this is the longest bridge owned and maintained, managed by the City of St. Paul at about over 2,000 feet long. Every small repair is a large one, and just to give you that background history, in 2014, this condition came along in part because the city was noticing the need for some above routine maintenance, and on a bridge of this size, even a small repair becomes a very large financial obligation. I believe that just a replacement of some of the joints on this bridge, as well as some localized repairs, were being planned at that time with a price tag of well over $1 million. And some of those finances were, of course, required in order to get us to the stage that we are now with our analysis on the bridge. Thank you.
Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up to Representative Vogel's comments, we're being asked for almost $43 million on this. And my question to you, Mr. Christensen, is, okay, so how are you arriving at these cost figures? We're showing some pictures here, but do you have in your bid process or just engineering estimates design for a new bridge? What type of design? We have seen nothing in terms of what we're going to be approving here. How many lanes? And I think we did learn something from the 35W bridge, that being that you can build a bridge pretty economically, pretty quickly when you have to. And, you know, we're being presented here with one figure for a new bridge. But as we all know, there's lots of different ways to build anything. And is there a more economical figure that could be derived for a different design on a bridge?
Mr. Christensen.
Chair, Representative, the figure, the preliminary cost estimate, which has been developed and is presented to you today, reflects a rather modest bridge structure, and we did make every attempt with our consultants to understand that this is a huge financial ask, and that we need to provide something that supports the vitality that Mayor Coleman had spoken to, while at the same time is accountable for the cost effectiveness or the economy of what we're doing. The bridge figure before you, I would be happy to provide a more detailed breakdown of costs. There are roadway items associated with the project. There are intersections at Mounds Boulevard and towards Broadway at the Union Depot associated with the cost estimate. And particular to the bridge, the approach of which is bounded by two retaining walls structures, the bridge itself was estimated based on the most economical beam design available that provides a 75 to 100 year lifespan. That is a pre-stressed concrete beam structure. It is not as ornate or as aesthetically artistic as a structure such as the Lafayette Bridge or the 35W replacement bridge, but it does provide a better, it provides a possibility for the incorporation of elements that are more suitable to the image of the bridge as a gateway community, such as more ornamental rustications on parapet railings, such as we see on the I-94 corridor, or the city standard ornamental railing, a metal railing with pickets, as well as some ability to improve the lighting for pedestrians and bicyclists.
A follow-up, Representative Uglin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you enlighten me on who your engineer, which engineering firm provided your cost estimates?
Absolutely. SRF Consulting.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. I believe I've run out of questions. Okay. Very good. Well, any closing comments, Mr. Mayor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, first of all, and members of the committee. We do understand the tremendous pressures that you have relative to bonding requests, and we know that there are a lot of good projects out there. But I do believe that each of these projects either addresses a very, very urgent need or really advances the work that we are doing to educate and promote vitality in the city of St. Paul, and we appreciate your support.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Mr. Mayor, and thank you for taking care of us here in your fine city. We appreciate
your host. We're glad to do so. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we are adjourned.